All right. So let's. The only bad thing about coffee breaks is that inevitably you lose part of the audience, and that's what I was trying to avoid. But I guess there was greater demand for coffee than for audience. But no, we're doing very well. We're still doing very well. So Pablo, you have about 15 minutes to do the presentation of the chapter, and then I'll invite the members of the panel. I'll then introduce the members of the panel as they come.
Okay, you control my time, okay, Mauricio? Okay, so this is the last chapter of the report, and we think this was a very important issue to talk about, because the idea is that, as I told you, the second part of the chapter of the book deals with management strategies, and the chapter 5 deals with, how much public participation versus private participation, they are there on the services in the region. Is in the case of private participation, what type of regulation should be in place? So we got a lot of detail on that. Then chapter 6 deals with some distributional policies to take. And chapter 7 deals specifically with once we decided that private participation is important because it has some benefits, what is the type of scheme that could be in place? Let's say privatization was one thing, but a very important scheme that has been used in the region lately was private-public participation, in which both the private sector and the public sector collaborate, coordinate in the provision of public services. So this chapter deals with how we set the institutional arrangement such that we assure that all these regulations that we say are important to be in place so that the private sector participates in the services, and also all the public investment that should be done in sectors that are not profitable for the private sector, so also the public policy is applied and is in practice, it's not, we don't deviate from the plans we have. So this is the idea of this chapter, okay? The idea of this chapter, this is the structure of the chapter. We first have a section on the political economy of infrastructure provision. The idea you will see is that in practice, there are pressures from the private sector. The public sector is not just one agent. There are various agents, the Congress, executive power, subnational government, and many of these public agents has an agenda that many times is not only to maximize public welfare. So the idea is that there is a kind of a policy game, and we want to understand first what are the reasons for which we can have some kind of deviations in the result of policies as a result of this policy game. And then we want to deal with which are the institutions that we have to set up so that we minimize those deviations from the public policy that maximize welfare. That's the idea of the whole chapter. So as an introduction, as I said, we say that the public sector faces a lot of constraints in the management of infrastructure services. As I said, the public sector is constituted by many, many different organisms, ministries, Congress, etc. But also enterprises and industries constitute interest groups that seek to influence public policy decision and, of course, get through lobbying and other mechanisms. And many times, this policy influence may not result in the best policies in terms of public welfare. Of course, consumers also try to influence public policy directly through consumer association or indirectly through support for political candidates or particular policies. As I said, then, the net effect of all these factors not always results in the policies that maximize social welfare. So we need to understand better about these policy games. So the first part is about understanding these forces, and this is the political economy and infrastructure provision. And in here, we just have data from one paper which we found for the paper by Dresden and Slavar done for Colombia, in which they sort of put an example of how public investment decision on infrastructure could be motivated by factors that are not only related to maximize public welfare. And this is the electoral cycle affecting investment decision. And here on the left-hand side panel, we have data on investment spending in Colombia, in infrastructure, in election versus non-election years. And on the left-hand side, we have infrastructure sector. On the right-hand side, we have current expenditures, not related to infrastructure. So the idea is to show that, in particular, the infrastructure investment is subject to this electoral cycle. Because, you know, there is a huge literature about that. The idea is that infrastructure project could give a signal about the capacity of the government. So if the government in election time, in election year, wants to send a signal about its capacity as, you know, to manage public policies, many times could announce some big infrastructure projects, okay? And you will see that the data reflects that type of facts, okay? And the idea, of course, is that the demand for infrastructure is not related with electoral time. You know, it's related with the long-term sort of trends related to the growth of the economy, to the growth of population, etc. It's not related the demand to electoral, you know, to the electoral cycle. So if you will take decisions on infrastructure, you know, just saying invest a lot in electoral years, you are not doing the right policy, okay? So that's the whole thing, to document that. And for example, in electoral years, infrastructure spending grows like 42% compared to non-electoral years. Okay, this is the thing. Now, of course, this type of evidence you will find for many other countries, not only developing countries. You find it for developed countries as well. And there is another paper by Cadot et al., 2006, in which they show that electoral and lobbying type of activity was also important, not only for the allocation of public investment across time, meaning in election years you increase the expenditure, but also across space. And of course, those regions in France that have more lobby and have much political power, they show that the allocation of public investment in those regions is much important. Okay? So electoral considerations and lobby activity also have implications for the geographic distributions of investment in infrastructure. And again, the idea is that the demand for public investment in infrastructure is not related in principle to those variables. Okay. Now, not only we have problems of deviation of public investment decisions with respect to the optimal policy, but also public policy affecting regulation and, of course, affecting then private sector decision on investment. And this is related to the problem of credibility in regulated policy. The idea is that lobbying and electoral incentives may also disturb regulated policy. On one hand, we say that public announcements about regulation issues like tariffs for certain infrastructure services, etc., could be not credible. Why? Because government face different incentives, say, before the investment are done and after the investment are done. So before the investment is done, the government has incentive to announce, say, high prices of utilities, so this will assure private sector to recuperate the fixed investment cost and to run the firm in a profitable way. Of course, once the firms have done this huge investment in infrastructure, the government could have incentive ex post to reduce the tariff that was previously announced to a level very above operational costs. In this way, the firms could not recuperate the fixed cost, but still will be economically profitable to run the business. Okay, and why will do that the government? Well, could maximize, let's say, consumer surplus. This could be good for the electoral reasons, etc. So we've seen many governments. I will not give names so no one gets sort of. We see a lot of governments having done this kind of opportunistic policies, with regard to regulations issues in infrastructure. But not only the public sector behaves opportunistically in terms of infrastructure services and regulation. Also, the private sector has also different ex-ante and ex-post incentives in regard with the infrastructure. For example, the private sector could have incentive to offer in an auction very low prices for their services, you know, very high objectives in terms of service coverage, to win, of course, the concession. And after, you know, they won the concession, it could sort of renegade on some of those promises, renegotiate with some excuse with the government, you know, asking for higher prices of the services, asking for higher costs, whatever. And of course, the government may have to, you know, may have to face that and may agree to do that because, you know, ex post, if the government says do not agree with that, the service could be cut and probably there will be problems with the services, people would get mad, et cetera, et cetera. So there are reasons. So that's why you also find incentives from the private sector to behave opportunistically. Okay? And of course, here is José Luis, that he has been working a lot on these issues, and there is a lot of evidence on, as you said, on renegotiations of concession on infrastructure services contracts, both motivated by the public sector opportunistic behavior, but also by the private sector. Okay? Now, so this is a sort of a diagnosis that why is that you may say that there are deviations from optimal policy, both in public sector investment decision and also in regulation policies. Now, what institution could set up so to avoid those deviations? First, what institution could help to soften political cycles and lobbies affecting public investment decision? Here we have, in the chapter, we have three cases which I think is interesting. First, the idea to promote investment planning on the public sector and also multi-year budgets. And here is the case, the Brazil case. Sorry. The Brazil case with the 2004 and 2007 multi-year plan, which incorporates some novel features, like, for example, a territorial approach on the investment planning. So the idea is the territorial approach is very good. Is good because it could coordinate the investment of many sectors, infrastructure sector, on the same land, on the same region, and take into account the complementarity that you have among many services. So this is good. This is why it's good. The territorial approach to planning. Okay. Second, not only you plan, you incorporate in the plan the public investment, but also the private investment that also is going to be made in that region. So again, to maximize the complementarity between public and private investment. And third, in the Brazil case, you have the integration of planning information and those of the budget process. So many times the planning areas of the government make these very nice plans about investment flows, etc., for per sector and in terms of region, etc. But this has no correspondence with the budgetary decisions and budgetary sort of records. So it's very difficult to follow up whether, you know, the investment are being done and which sector is investing in which area. So this is a thing that the Brazilian plan has and is a very good feature. Okay, so now, sorry. The second example to improve, the second type of institution to improve public investment decisions is this national public investment system in Peru. Here we have the Peruvian former Minister of Finance, so I'm a little bit afraid of saying things about Peru. But in Peru, there was established this national Peruvian planning system for public investment. And the idea is that all public investment has to go through a very serious scheme of public evaluations, okay, ex-ante evaluations. And this was very good because it sort of implied a strong discipline on how to evaluate projects, what type of benefit to look at, how to measure costs, etc. Now, The system has received some criticisms because it was said that it stopped or it make much more longer all the planning, you know, all the decisions take that all the time it takes for a project to be implemented. Now, especially because regions in Peru that have a lot of funds because of the royalties from oil and mining revenues. So all the regions have all this money for investment in infrastructure, and they had to wait a lot of time to implement those because of this regime is very technically very demanding. Now in Peru they do it they sort of decentralize the system in a very nice way. So they sort of allow regions to have their own system of evaluation and to approve their own projects, and also they send finance employees, Minister of Finance, people of employees to the regions to help the regions with this kind of evaluation system. So this was a nice example of how to make this kind of evaluation system work in practice. Okay. Finally, a thing that also is related with how to manage public investment is the idea that, as I showed you before, many public investment decisions are sort of suffer from fiscal adjustment policies, in the sense that many countries of our region have taken up or have approved what we call fiscal rules that, you know, they demand certain objectives for the fiscal surplus. So, and these are very hard rules, and it's very nice that our country have taken those. Now, many times because of when, you know, the recession comes, the only way to maintain those objectives number for fiscal surplus is to cut public investment in infrastructure. So in here, what we, in the discussion in this chapter, so here I said fiscal rule as one of the reasons of the downward trend in public investment. Some people have documented that. Now, some people, like Servan, has a paper in which they say that it's not true that the cut in productive public investment helps to strengthen fiscal solvency of the country. Why? Because if those public investments improve growth in the medium and long term, that would, of course, imply future increase in tax revenues. So while on the short, when you cut this investment, it gives you some liquidity gains in the short term, but it will give you some cost in long-term solvency because it will hurt growth in the long term, and it will hurt future, will decrease future fiscal tax revenues. So what are the alternative options, or what we can do to try to moderate this sort of bias that fiscal adjustment have on infrastructure expenditure? Well, there are some sort of proposals like a golden rule. Golden rule is just saying, you know, when you have an adjustment, you know, investment is just is saving. Public investment infrastructure is saving. So you take away all public investment from the objective surplus numbers. This is maybe two extremes. Another alternative is, as someone was saying here before, take away from the objective fiscal surplus the public investment involved in PPPs, in private-private partnerships. Why? Because the public investment that are in those kind of projects, they have passed the market tests, as Mauricio was saying. So if those public investment were done in a sort of in the context of PPPs, they must have passed the market test, so this investment must have been profitable. So this was the second alternative. The third alternative is to say you have to go to a net wealth approach, in the sense that if productive public investment increases future revenues, you know, on one hand, you may have some more debt because the public sector is investing more. But you have higher assets. So in net wealth term, you are not it's not true that the public sector is worse off, because you have more debt, but you have more assets, and you have some productive assets. So these are different alternatives that are discussed in the literature. I would say that a midpoint alternative could be to make an exception for productive public investment, especially those that are evaluated, okay, and through this national system of public infrastructure evaluation, and also those projects that have independent future projections on tax income. So you take away from this objective fiscal surplus measures, those investment in public infrastructure that not only have been evaluated correctly, but also they have like projection of future tax revenues, okay? And this project has been done by independent sort of agencies. The idea is that this assures that this investment will pay for itself. For example, Chile has this framework. Okay, so these are institutions to improve the management of public investment in infrastructure. Now let's go to institutions that improve the regulatory governance. Okay, first, one thing, very important thing, is the separation of functions. The idea is that, as José Luis may say that. In his comment, there is an argument for separating functions. On one hand, those related to strategic planning, identification of projects, and evaluation, which should be done by sectoral ministers. Then it could be a sort of a phase where the planning minister or the finance minister do kind of a coordination and filtering. A third, then you have a PPH, so a public-private partnership agency that is in charge of attract private sector investment and design contracts. You see? Then there should be an independent regulatory agency that oversees the compliance regarding those contracts. So is that, on one hand, we have separate agents that do separate things, and it's good to have this separation. What is very important is to separate the planning identification project phase with those, and also the one that the idea that the agency that brings the private sector in and designs contract to the agencies that are in charge of controlling the compliance of the contracts. This is very important. Okay. Finally, if we want to have independent regulatory agencies, how we define an independent regulatory agency? Well, there are, on one hand, the idea that there are some certain basic characteristics that can strengthen their autonomy. Of course, one is organizational and budgetary independence, fixed term of office for directors, adequate technical personnel, you know, etc. But also it's important that this agency has transparent administrative procedures because these agencies are not accounted by, you know, the electoral rules. So they are like, you know, beyond the electoral sort of discipline. So how they are legitimized in front of the population, of the citizens? Well, they have to have this transparency. They have to be very transparent in terms of all the projects they do. So they must be publicized, etc. And also, it should be the possibility to judicial review and also some consumer type of defense. Okay, so you see, I deal with institutions to improve management of public investment, and then I deal with institutions to improve the regulatory governance. Okay, both are necessary. Finally, let me finish saying that, as I said, the implementation of public policy in infrastructure faces a lot of constraints of electoral type, lobbies, etc. There are rules and pressures to institutional mechanisms that help to avoid this. As I said, with regard to public investment, reinforce planning and assessment capacity in public sector, implementing multi-year budget, etc. Special consideration could be given in the budget to the public investment associated with infrastructure. With regard to the private sector participation in infrastructure, the public sector should improve planning and evaluation capacity. You know, it is important that even in those areas of infrastructure where the private sector will have a very important role, the public sector should have strength, should have capacity to evaluate those, because many times those private PPP initiatives will have implied subsidies from the public sector. So you need to legitimize, in face of the public who will pay those subsidies, the idea that it is worthwhile to pay those subsidies. So that's why the public sector has to have independent capacity to evaluate those projects. Because, of course, the private sector will bring you an evaluation that will say that the project is profitable. Okay? But then the public sector should be in capacity to have their own opinion on that. And between this debate and dialogue is what you have the truth is going to be in the middle of the room. Okay? So that is what is very important. So to have a dynamic private sector participating in infrastructure, you have to have a strong public sector with this capacity of planning and evaluating projects. There is no shortcut for improving infrastructure, giving all the way to the private sector. This is not the way. Okay. Now, okay, so finally, let me say that regional cooperation may strengthen also national capacity of identifying, planning, and evaluating infrastructure investment. I would say there are some initiatives at regional integration, like IRSA and the also Andean community, in which they have also gone beyond trade and helped to produce infrastructure projects to integrate physically the countries. Okay, and they have helped individual countries to strengthen planning and evaluation activities. Okay, this is it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me now ask the members of the panel to join me here, and Pablo as well. I'll just say a few words about the panelists. Please join me. Carolina Renteria, she's now the executive director from Colombia at the World Bank, and up until about 3 months ago, she was the director of the National Planning Department in Colombia. The National Planning Department, by the way, is the government agency in charge of the investment budget of the country. Claudio Loser is, some of you probably know, is affiliated with Inter-American Dialogue now, but was the director of the Western Hemisphere department at the IMF, and in that condition participated in many of the negotiations between the IMF and the countries in the region, some of which touched on these issues of institutions and fiscal management of infrastructure. And José Luis Wash is a very well-known expert in this area, has been with the World Bank for many years, and is now the senior regional advisor on regulation and competition practice. It's the leader of the PPP global expert team at the World Bank, and is now also, as I understand, a professor of economics at the University of California in San Diego. Great deal of experience on the topic, and many, many publications from José Luis, some of which actually are an input to this report, and a person that it's undoubtedly one of the leading experts in the world on the subject. So I think we have a great panel. I'm going to ask each one of the panelists to take about 10 minutes at maximum, and then we'll allow you to participate as well with your comments and questions. So who wants to start? Or I'll moderate, yes. I don't know if who wants to take the lead. I don't know what the order originally was. Is there any preference? Do you want to start, Claudio? So then we'll do Carolina and then Jose Luis.
Okay. I don't know if I had sent in a PowerPoint presentation, but I guess it has disappeared. So as you know, PowerPoints are a replacement or a substitute for eloquence, and now you'll see that the eloquence is not there. But we'll live with that anyway. But
do you need help?
Nope, I think. No. Let me see. I don't know if there is. Yep, here it is. All right. So you will not be subject to my eloquence, fortunately for all of you. All right. Of course, I had a number of brilliant remarks until I discovered that the brilliant remarks had been made before I spoke. So I just want to, I'll go over some of my slides very quickly, but the first thing I want to say is I've been a commentator of the Red de Reportes de Economía y Desarrollo for quite a while, and I have to say that this fifth study is really a very an excellent continuation. And for those of us who teach Latin American economics in different places, we have found that this not only is a tremendous asset in terms of the understanding of for Latin America, but it should be required reading in any decent course in Latin American economics. If you look at the various issues, and I really believe that this is a tremendous contribution that CAF has been doing, and this study is certainly a proof of that. Now, in terms of the importance of infrastructure, in my view, I'm looking into the whole issue of a prosperous Latin America for the future in a study that we're working for CAF, and you have really the three elements are an inclusive society, a competitive economy, and an integrated continent, and in the three cases, you really need to have a strong infrastructure. And of course, this is a simplification of what has to be done. But certainly, this is one of the major challenges that Latin America has ahead. I won't go into the whole issue of Latin America and how it has been lagging other regions, but I just like to show this little chart, which shows based on 1995 per capita income, this is per capita income on a PPP basis, but it's not of the private-public partnership type. But it's purchasing power parity. And what it shows is, of course, it shows developing Asia growing enormously. But the terrible story is, of course, it depends on where you make the point. If you were to make it in 2003, it would look slightly different. But basically, Latin America lags the advanced economies and developing Asia. Central and Eastern Europe is, I'm afraid, an anomaly that reminds me of the times of the debt crisis of Latin America of the early 80s. So I would not put that much emphasis on that. But this is tremendously important to understand where we are. Now, this is something I took from one of the studies that CAF prepared, and it shows how Latin America does in terms of the quality of infrastructure within the world, and it's sort of in the second half. And the interesting thing is if you look at the studies of the ease of doing business in Latin America that is produced by the World Bank, this is for 181 countries, and I took the 2008 numbers. The average, this is a simple average for the sample, for Latin America is sort of in the second half. And what you see is that there is a high correlation between sort of the ability to do business, and we can go into all sorts of other indicators, and there are 10 different or 15 different types of indices that measure these things, but Latin America is sort of in, not even in the middle, it's below the middle. There are countries that have been doing well, and you have Chile, Mexico, Peru, Colombia that have been doing well, but the biggies have not been doing that well, unfortunately. Now, let me philosophize a little bit about the role of institutions. As I, in my distant youth, was part of the Washington Consensus, and now I'm not in my youth, but I'm still viewed as part of the Washington Consensus. I leave that aside. But the important thing is that there was a tremendous improvement in infrastructure. I would say that although it's arguable, the policies were very good, but there was no change in the institutions. I'm not, this is sort of a blanket statement, and we can go over a number of countries or a number of cases, and I think that the study shows this, but fundamentally, there was no construction of institutions beyond the individuals that were doing the policies. And this was a weakness that, unfortunately, was not viewed in time. And the whole issue of infrastructure was a serious problem. Of course, now we have tended to forget that state-owned ownership of infrastructure of all types in Latin America, certainly in my country, Argentina, was a total disaster. And the privatization was seen as the solution. And being the solution, people said, okay, we are going to sort of religiously go into privatization as a change of the institutional setup. But unfortunately, what happened was that a number of privatization processes resulted in the capture of sectors by the private sector, private monopolies. And I can think of a number of countries where the government increased tariffs in order to make attractive packages, and then the private sector took over, say, telephones in northern and southern countries in the region, and they captured the whole sector, not necessarily with the greatest degree of efficiency. Other privatizations were directed to the private sector that was close to the government in place, and that again was a serious problem. Other privatizations were handled very poorly. The capturing by private monopolies and the giving companies to the friends in the line of the Russian monopolies, and that was followed very closely in Latin America, of course, was a part of that. But fundamentally, I would say that privatization tended to work well, but the reputational effect was catastrophic, was a disaster. And I think that the study is very correct in its assessment. And I was really fascinated by the whole issue of the political cycles and how the political cycles destroy the continuity. And, of course, this happens in Latin America. It happens in developing. It happens in developed countries. And there is a need for long-term planning. I mean, I'm just reiterating what has been said before. And I think that the budgetary institutional process is important, and there has to be a need for support of the support for these projects, and there has to be the capacity to punish, because the problem is that there is no clear punishment. Now, You've already heard about the cooperation between private and public sector. I won't go too much into this, except to say that you need stable rules. And one of the serious, very serious problems that we had in Latin America is the lack of continuity in terms of rules. The private sector, other than the pirate type of private sector, which is associated with the pirate public sector, wants stable rules more than nice and soft rules. And this is exceedingly important. And then there has to be also a guarantee against the state actions or government actions, the sovereign takes actions that have to be, that it has to take responsibility for in all these projects. Now, Pablo before has been talking about protecting the infrastructure from capture, in a way, from the private and the public sector. I also want to say that there are serious problems in terms of stakeholders. It seems stakeholder is seen as a positive item generally. But when we look at the stakeholders, there are really also actions, political actions, populist actions, that effectively destroy the strength of the of infrastructure. And the labor unions frequently, and this has been the case certainly in my country, I will not go into other countries at this point, they have also, under the notion that they have to protect, the capacity and they have to protect the well-being of the people, they basically take over and they frequently end up destroying the capacity of the companies to provide good services. So just to finalize, of course, there is a need for adequate international cooperation, and this, I think, is enormously important as it is discussed in the paper. And also there is a need to recognize what the limitations are, the capacity of the governments to finance, the need for private sector and for the international financial institutions. The other thing is one cannot be ideological about these things. I think good policies are part of a pragmatic approach and not part of dogmatism. And final thing is that one has to defend in some way equity. This is exceedingly important, but it has to be done through other mechanisms than pricing or destroying the infrastructure. So fundamentally, I think that the report is great in general and in this particular area as well, but there is a long road ahead that needs to be paved because there will be a lot of traffic in there. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Claudio. Let me now turn to Carolina Renteria.
Thank you. First, I want to thank for the invitation, and I have to tell that I agree that this is a very good report, and for me, it was a great pleasure to read Chapter 8, given my background. I was national budget director in Colombia for 4 years, from 2002 to 2006, and then I became the director of National Planning Department, which Mauricio Cárdenas was also director of National Planning Department in Colombia, which basically is like a ministry of planning that deals with the capital investment, with all the sectoral issues, the design of policies, and the integration among the policies. And it has a very strong role in trying to coordinate the different entities, the different sectors, the different levels of government, because Colombia is a decentralized government with the national sector, departmental and municipalities, and very decentralized, which makes the coordination role very challenging. So for me to read this chapter was a complete pleasure. It brought me back to old times. And I have to say that I tried to go away from just Colombian experience, but in this time I'm going to talk about the Colombian experience as a whole in relation to the second part of the chapter, which deals with the institutions and how they work, should work, and what doesn't work. Basically, the chapter provides a material, and the clear message is we need to enforce planning, budgeting, and evaluation. I completely agree with it. I completely agree that many times we have the budgeting completely, or not completely, but not as correlated with the planning as it should be. And many times good ideas just remain in the desk of the public officials and they don't get executed. And I would say that this paper could deal, or if you're going to still work on it, with two more things that I think are very needed and useful. One is execution. We can have budgeting, we can have planning, but at the end of the day is whether we are able to execute the project that we say we are going to build, and whether that execution is done in a timely fashion, is done with the correct resources, and if the project is efficient and has good quality, which is measured by analyzing the results. And also because the chapter deals a lot with public-private partnerships and how to work with public sector and private sector, I would say one thing that we public officials and policymakers need to work much more is on selling the countries, on being able to sell what our projects are, what our visions are, what our goals are, and trying to get the private sector, not only the national private sector, but private sectors from other parts of the world. Capital is a scarce resource. Right now in this crisis, it's even more. And only those countries that have been able to show that they have the projects, but they are able to sell themselves in the market, not only having good policies, not only having good macro, not only having a correct framework, but having a pool of projects. Planeación Nacional is an institution 50 years old in Colombia. And basically, it has had this role of coordination of projects. And I think Colombia is a good case study in order to see how institutionalities can really move forward processes. And in the project, in the paper, you have different Planeación Nacional is named in many times. One is as the design of what it's called the agenda interna, which was the definition of projects in infrastructure that regions wanted to do because, or they wanted to become more competitive. And it showed how it's possible to do a planning approach from below from the municipalities to the central government. It was quite a challenge. It took almost 3 years. But what was more important of it, it was owned by the municipalities, done in a technical way, and then it was included in the national plan for the years 2007-2010, and then it started to be put in the budget on a yearly basis. So here we see an example of how to deal issues of competitiveness going from the regions to the center, but being able to prioritize it at the central government. It is very hard, and I share Mauricio's remembrances of being in Congress. I also had to be long hours in Congress trying to explain why things couldn't be made. If you are 4 years director of national budget and 3 years director of Planeación Nacional, you are Miss No. You are always saying, no, you can't. It's impossible. We don't have enough resources. We need to prioritize. We need to. So it's important to have the institutions, but also it's important to be an active player in this process, to go to Congress, to try to explain. Nobody will understand. They will never give you the reason. You're always the bad person. But you have to be engaged in the political process, because if that's one of the ways I think the government has in order to try to prevent or to try to get better results. Basically, so there are different ways on how to engage with public-private decision of projects. Colombia has built a very strong, I think, institution this moment called La National Competitiveness Policy, where we have public and private participation from all sectors trying to build a consensus agenda on what needs to be prioritize in terms of infrastructure. And the paper deal has a chapter or a box on the Cámara Colombiana de la Infraestructura, which I think is, and I agree completely with the assessment made, that that's completely private sector. The big players in terms of infrastructure are our members, and we work and negotiate and have a very open dialogue between the public and the private sector in what roads are needed, which ports should be expanded, what interventions in terms of airports, all this infrastructure that are needed. Obviously, they always say government never puts enough money. We always say we want the private sector to be more involved. But basically, it's good to have a way in which public and private sector can work together. In terms of planning and budgeting, Colombia has made very important changes back from when Mauricio Cárdenas was Director of Planeación Nacional and Ministry of Transportation. We have a responsibility law in 2003 was enacted. We made reforms to the budgetary system. In 2005, we introduced a multi-year budget system, medium-term expenditure framework. Now ministries not only fight for their yearly budget, but they fight for 4 years of budget, which is good because you can really assess what are going to be the impacts of maintaining the infrastructure, and also because if it's a very important or if it's an infrastructure project, you never do it in 1 year. It always takes 2, 3, 4 years, and many times ministers just say, just give me $100 million for 1 year and that's it. That's never it. It's 100 this year, 120 next year, and 80 the following. So this has given Colombia like a system in which to these prioritizations. And also there was a reform that in the investment project data set that Planeación Nacional has been managing for 40 years, in order to have the regional impact of the projects and how the execution of the projects are going. Because we need to move from plans and from projects in the offices to how the resources are being executed. In terms of minimizing opportunistic behavior of the private sector, since the 1991 Constitution, Colombia has moved forward in terms of bringing the private sector in the execution of infrastructure. Back in 1994, there was a law for public services, and independent regulatory agencies were created for telecommunications, for energy, and for water. I would say energy and telecommunications work very well. Water, we have a lot of problems right now, and we have had in the last 15 years. And the strange thing, or the challenging thing, is there was no regulatory agency created for the transportation sector. And basically, one of the questions that nowadays flow in the Colombian environment is whether infrastructure in transport is lagging behind the other sectors, maybe because we didn't have the regulatory system placed back at the same time with the other sectors. And right now, we don't have an independent regulatory system for the transportation sector. It's very difficult. It's a very difficult decision and negotiation within government. At this moment, the Ministry of Transportation has gained all the battles in order not to have an independent regulatory institution for the transport sector, and we are lagging in terms of infrastructure investment. So I would say Colombia is a good example in terms of the regulatory framework. And the fourth and last issue that I found interesting was IRSA. The IRSA is Iniciativa for Integración Regional Suramericana de Infraestructura. It's the South American Infrastructure Integration Effort. Being Director of Planeación Nacional, I was president of IRSA in 2007. So it was very interesting to see the huge amount of information and data that all the countries of South America have in terms of investment projects in energy, in transport, and also I think it's a very good instrument, but very subutilized. It's not given its whole potential. I think there's a completely, I made like, Planeación Nacional was in charge of it. I didn't know it existed until I had to assume my duties as president. So I went to talk to all the Ministry of Energy, the Ministry of Transportation, the Ministry of Telecommunications. None of them in Colombia knew about it. So I think there's a huge potential, because there's a mechanism in which the countries are saying, I have the projects. There's an agenda of projects. They were built long time ago, and I think that's also an area where improvement can be made, because it's very difficult to update the projects. And infrastructure, you have to update projects. If not, you will remain with projects long time ago. Nobody paid attention back then. Maybe nobody will pay attention right now. And the projects that are being done are not into this new agenda. But I think there is a very good opportunity in that exercise of IRSA of having a Latin America strategy for infrastructure and for integration. And basically, I hope you continue working in these areas. And I think it's very important. And I think what Claudio Loser said, institutions are very important, really are very important in order to be able to make plans become true and to make investments as effective and as better quality as possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then last but not least, José Luis Wash.
Again, thanks very much to the CAF and the Brookings for hosting this event on an issue which is very dear to us, all of the multilateral and bilateral. And again, we're most eager, again, to support. Let me be sharp and focused as much as I can. This chapter, again, is really excellently done, and it does hit the right points. So indeed, I'll strongly support. And if anything, they might go a bit further, but obviously there are limits to the work and what have you, but it does lay down the critical elements, again, that are needed for a good infrastructure program. Okay, let me take now a step back and give a little bit of a framework on some of the issues and concerns that I have on the region. Those of us that look at this issue of infrastructure, I mean, what we have in mind ultimately is sector performance. Okay? It's got to be the coherence and improvement of sector performance in infrastructure, both in the short term and also in the long term, according for all dynamic issues that take into place. Again, and that is where, in my view, the problem starts and ends. For that, you do need, again, some coherence and some institutionality and some implementation. And that, it sounds very good, but yet, unfortunately, in Latin America, it doesn't happen systemically. Okay? I mean, from my own evaluation, there's not a single country that I would really, you know, really bless and saying they are doing, again, this process in a systemic way from beginning to end, along the lines that, you know, Pablo has mentioned, and the way to go forward. Okay? If you look from the ex ante, what I call a war of the infrastructure for the exposed, which is the oversight, once the infrastructure has been awarded, again, there is not, again, single country that had a systemic process. And by systemic process, I mean a country that starts with the planning strategy of what infrastructure is needed, when and how, and obviously constrained by the existing finance. And that is where you need to have to spell out what will you do, again, and why, with public funds like Obra Pública, or what we will do with, again, PPPs or variants of that one. Or what would you do with Obra Pública, yet, again, managed by the private sector, what have you. This is a coherent strategy and has to come, again, strictly from the line ministries. Once that is done, again, you need, again, this filtering, because you don't want, again, these white elephants and what have you. And remember that study after study illustrates that Latin America, even though they are spending very little in infrastructure, around the 2%, with some exceptions, Colombia is one of them and Chile is another. I mean, we always argue for this 4 or 5% as a percent of GDP. What they spend badly. Okay? So this famous 2%, in terms of effectiveness, is more like equivalent to 1.2%. Okay? And this part of this process of, again, not doing the things consistently and quietly. So this is why you need, again, somehow this filtering, you know, instruments mostly led by the Ministry of Finance and the like. And then you need these agencies, the PPP, and obviously the regulatory agency, which again is has to be separate, independent, and outside. But which country has this structure and why they don't have it? You tell me. Chile, the example, fails at least in two of these elements. Okay? At least doesn't have the independent regulatory agency, particularly in transport. That one, transport, you mentioned it, I think were you. In Latin America, there are only two, maybe three countries that they have an independent or autonomous regulatory agency in transport. The rest of them, and you know, you guys have fought it, we guys have fought it, and so on, there's no way we move forward. Even Chile, in the new law, they're trying to set up the superintendencia of concessions. It was blocked by the private sector, and it's not going to go anywhere, and it's Chile, okay? And the only two countries is Peru and Bolivia, and there's a third one that maybe how you measure, evaluate. So this is a critical issue. The issue is that why is that happening? Why are we having systemic problems? Part of the problems of not having this structure are evidenced by increased timing and delay of projects, poorly designed concession contracts or PPP contracts. Why is that happening? I mean, now we have, again, a blueprint of what we call best practice contract clauses or contract models, if you will, which are not being used systemically. Why is it that there's not enough capacity to move things forward faster? Okay. I mean, it seems that, and some, maybe you might blame the Ministry of Finance, you might blame what have you, but it's always an issue of resources, which is, in my view, counterproductive, because quite often, because you're not willing to allocate an extra $1 million to build capacity on these units which are thinking and designing the planning and implementation, you end up really expending, expose $20 to $50 million in trying to correct some of the problems of design. I mean, that indeed is really a faulty process which into place. Same thing is with the oversight and regulation and that one. I mean, we have mentioned about the issue of capture and the like, and the evidence illustrates. When I first, you know, wrote the book on renegotiation, it was on 204. Now we're in 209, but the same problems, I mean, I've been computing additional statistics, and the evidence and incident of renegotiation remains. And again, quite often at the expense of the damage of the users and the public sector. That one. Again, to me, the question that we need to pose is, why is it that knowing that what we know, these countries are not more willing to systematize, stratify the process of infrastructure planning, implementation, execution, and oversight? We know how it should be done. Yet, as I mentioned, there's not a single country in Latin America that would say they're doing it right. Some have some aspects, you know, which are better. I mean, I would say that probably the closest one, and not perfect, is Peru, probably. With some, again, you know, issues here and there, and that one, and they could be improved significantly. Yet, again, all complain, and they play the blame job. You know, the finance blames the Ministry of Linea, the Ministry of Line of Linea, blame finance, or blame the regulation, and so on. It's the blame game, which leads into the case that we have not enough infrastructure. Okay, another point which sometimes is over, not really well understood or misunderstood. Again, we have seen that infrastructure spending, you know, has dropped down significantly from the 70s, where the public sector was done. When the private sector came in, the public sector really retracted, and the private sector, as they say, did not invest enough to make up for the gap, which is correct, but. And the but is, and again, I've been the first one to hit very hard into the private sector for opportunistic behavior, and I still do. And again, and they are not pirates, and that, I mean, I'm really guns against, I will really argue that to the end. There are a few pirates, but many of them, they are not pirates. They are businessmen. If you give them an opportunity for making money, they will do it. You know, I mean, that, and this is what you and I should do and will do if we're to be running an Odebrecht type of institutional organization. If you say that you give me a window, that an opportunity to, again, to reduce investment or to increase tariff, I will do it. This is not piracy. This is the normal business of private sector. This is not altruistic concepts. You know, work a good contract and honor it. That's the problem, that neither the government nor the private sector has been willing to consistently honor it. Even in Peru, I mean that. I mean, in the recent, there was a decree passed, I think maybe you were gone on that one. And I had, you know, they consulted with me this issue about contract degree should not be changed at least for a short period, maybe 3 to 5 years. Okay? Because to me, I mean, again, a contract, it is a contract, and you can really account for many of the issues in contingent clauses, on variations. It's not that the contract is never changed. No, in the contract can say, in the event there is an earthquake, in the event there is really a derrumbamiento de tierra, in the event that is this or that, then the contract will be adjusted. So there is a number of standard clauses which protect you as the investor for these type of events which are difficult to predict and difficult to insure against. That should be part of contract modification, but that is not contract renegotiation. That's fine. Yet the arguments that the private sector tend to make is that, oh, like in the water sector, oh, right, you know, it just happened that the quality of the assets on the ground, they were not as good as we thought they were. Or the geography or topology of this on the road, it was much difficult and so on. Okay, my response to it is to say, this company, I mean, they've been doing or they are doing that day after day all over the world. They, again, have been faced with this type of outcomes, again, not 100 but 1,000 times. So they have a good distribution, what is largely defined. They do the due diligence. These things can be adjusted. So you tell me that I want an open contract so as that I can adjust for these things, doesn't make any sense. Yet the pressure really built in, and recently Peru did had to change and eliminate that clause that the contract said that at least for 5 years you are not allowed to change, to renegotiate the contract. The contract can be changed if the contract is stipulated. And I talk again extensively with the FIN, which, and they would in principle agree with me. They said, look, what you have to do is list the type of contingent events in the contract, and they are covered. And we know what are the classic ones and the most impacting ones. Yet, that was, anyway, this is part of the issue. And we have to understand that this is a complex matter, but there are issues which are business as usual. Fine, we can and should live with them. My problem is that when I see systemic, important problems, which happen time and time again. And this, I blame the government, in principle, because they are the ones that have to lead the process and put some order. And the private sector needs to be adjust. Again, quite often, things are really misunderstood on the issue of the export management and renegotiation. I mean, the government are really locked into a sort of quasi-capture. Why? Because, again, they fear losing, again, political capital and losing transaction costs. Typical example, and again, it happened from Mexico, again, in, well, the way to Argentina. Typical example was, I mean, sorry to keep selecting Peru, but has a beautiful set of good examples. When you awarded the LAP, a concession to the airport, it was really a great success. I mean, these guys were going to give you 47% of the gross revenues. It was going to have Frankfurt Airport and Bechtel. Wonderful deal. I mean, what more could you have? Top operators and give you 47% of gross revenues and so on. Okay? Well, 6 months after the award, began calling. The numbers do not match. I need help. Anyway, that's the longest story. It's been a number of negotiations, right? That one. Why the government would not say, look, this is a contract you sign. You like it? No? Fine. There's a performance bond that you lose, and then we re-auction it again. Well, at the time, sure, it was a crown jewel concession of Peru. The government, you know, had beat a bombo y platillo, the announcement of that. 6 months later, you say, no, we blew it for reason A or B. You lose political capital. The transaction, a transition cost of moving from the current allocation to the new one and so on. And the private sector knows it. So obviously, they test the government. They come to you, and then, again, if you open them a window, then obviously they come to it. So, I mean, again, that is the need to put some order and credibility, what Pablo was saying, that you need to have credibility on the part of regulation, on the part of the, again, oversight, and the part, again, of contracts. If not, again, these things are not going to be moving. The bottom line, and the question is that, again, why is it that the governments in Latin America are not really delivering in a systemic fashion the process and the institution to obtain the desired results? That one. And again, it is not that we don't know how to do it. Again, you know, we have sit down and we can within a day, and they know it anyway. That it's just a matter of this. There's a lot of money which has been moved in this sector. There's a lot of interest that might or might not like these things. There are sometimes things you want to do this thing fast because reasons A, B, or C, but at the end of the day, it happens that you don't invest as good as you could, and quite often you don't invest as much as you should. And I think this latter part is beginning to be corrected in the sense that governments understand the critical need of that. And they're beginning to think about alternative complementary, like a number of countries now are thinking about creating infrastructure investment funds or an infrastructure guarantee funds. Peru is one of them, Brazil is another one, and even Colombia is thinking on these issues as well, which are fine. I just hope that there are ways to do this thing right and there are ways to do this thing wrong. So I do hope that, again, these countries, again, think hard and, again, establish them as in the proper fashion, which will be conducive to obtain all these benefits that, again, infrastructure needs to have to deliver, again, the optimal results. But, again, coming back to the chapter, again, the institutions do matter significantly, and yet they need to be aligned, again, with the objectives that all of us want to have. And the chapter does a very good job on really pointing out the direction.
Thank you. Well, we're running out of time. I'm going to ask the audience if you have any pressing question for the panelists or for the lead presenter. Is there anyone in the audience wanting to ask a question? So we'll have the ambassador from Peru, and then we'll get a couple questions here. But four. That will be it. So we'll have four questions.
Well, thank you. There have been so many references to Peru that I feel a little bit forced to say a few things. First of all, I think the report, I have not seen the report, but the presentation has been very good, and I look forward to read it. It was mentioned that the issue of investment in infrastructure in particular is very complex, and indeed is very complex. We know that what needs to be done. We know the institutions that have to be put in place. We know about all the requirements to make sure things work the way we would like them to work. The question is why it's so difficult. And that's the political economy of the whole issue. And I think, and especially, well, the political cycle is one issue. But it's a power game. So the question is, how do you counter that power game? And maybe institutions are one way out, strong institutions. But I think it's as important as institutions are individuals and their capacity. I have heard these PPPs all along this morning, and it sounds like a panacea, and it's not. Because if you don't have the capacity in the government to negotiate what is the sharing of risk, and the private sector is, and we're highly specialized in that. It takes advantage of every window of opportunity, which is okay. But the question is the government prepared to do that? Because at the end, you may wind up with a public investment anyway, no matter what conditions you arrive at. Mm-hmm. And I don't agree with the issue of separating these investments that are pay for themselves out of the budget. The fiscal discipline. They have to be incorporated. If they are so good, well, they should be private, in essence. If they are self-financial, self-sustained, they should be private. What is preventing it from being private? But if they require government intervention, some form of guarantee, whether it is financial, non-financial, and so on, they have to be part of the planning, the fiscal planning. So I have it sounds very easy, a lot of things that we are saying, but I was asking earlier, we learn a lot in the process. We have learned through a number of years how costly it is to have private investment coming into infrastructure. Crisis in Mexico with all these problems with private roads. We have learned a lot since then. And Korea was mentioned this morning. We have learned much more than that. And Colombia is a precursor because you have a very complicated set of principles to evaluate PPPs. We tried to adopt it in Peru, and it was a nightmare, and a really a nightmare. It's so complex that people accuse the government of trying to prevent investment from taking place. I would like to ask a little bit, perhaps from Colombian, the two Colombians that we have here, what is your experience in that, and what would be your advice in that sense? How do you see the prospects of PPP in the future? And what is your main recommendation for that? Because I think that's a way to go, but it's not as easy as it sounds.
Thank you. Ricardo, then we'll go to Teresa, and then you'll be the last one. And please be sure, because we're losing the audience.
Something else which has been mentioned as a concern is about the state ownership by Claudio, that being not well handled by the state, the privatization was the solution. Colombia has been also an example on that. Colombia started selling the most inefficient entities of the government to private sector. But now, having proven that those institutions have increased their incomes and being more efficient, now they have turned into selling the efficient entities in order to provide financing for infrastructure. So is there any kind of balance of what should be the ownership of government and what should be the private ownership on those entities in order to provide proper financing for this infrastructure, taking into account that Latin America has a lack of money, a lack of income by the state, and they have to provide all kind of financing, and they have to be bring a lot of ideas in order to finance their budgets.
Thank you. Teresa.
I could talk about this for a very long time.
Well,
given that, in FAD we did a lot of work in this area. I would just like to make two points. First, I think that the worst response to the, and I'm talking basically about the fiscal rules and how to modify the fiscal rules. I think the worst response is a golden rule, because a golden rule is an incentive to approve any kind of project, no matter how poor it might be. I mean, there is no budget discipline. But there are many other reasons why this is not a good system. Of course, in principle, we all agree that net worth changes should be the indicator of preference. The problem is how to measure. The other point that I would like to stress is on public-private partnerships. I have not heard anybody mention the importance of transparency and evaluation and publication of the fiscal risks involved in PPPs. And I think this is a part of creating the right incentives for all parties involved to make not only an accurate evaluation, but also publicize heavily the fiscal risks involved. But again, on this, we have written a lot, and perhaps I can refer to those. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then you?
Yes, a very brief question. There's been some recognition on the panel of the need for more regional planning or integration. I wanted you to kind of have the panel tease out the opportunities and limitations of regional planning, specifically which sectors are best served or really require a regional approach to infrastructure planning. And then who should be the driver of this? Should it be ILSA? Should it be the IFIs? Should it be national donors like the MCC that take a multi-country or transnational approach to infrastructure? And what's really the best you can hope for? Is the best that you can really hope for information sharing and best practices, or can you really move towards true regional projects?
Okay, thank you very much. Now let's go back to Pablo.
A few things. Let me go to this thing of budget rules, because this is the more sort of provocative part of the report, and already have here a lot of complaints from former finance ministers, etc. Of course, we are totally right that fiscal rules are very important, and we don't want through this. We don't want investment, infrastructure investment, to be separated and and to imply through that kind of channel bad budgetary decisions. So that's why we are totally agree on that. We are simply saying that maybe to assure a stable financing for these things that are very intertemporal, some kind of closer look at those in terms of not only ex-ante evaluations, but also this private sort of, this independent expectation about future return is good. At least if you want to cut those investments, you cut it with a much more information and you do a much more rational decision of which of those investments are you going to be, sacrificing in a period of serious fiscal problems. So we are not trying to here to make, suggest very bad fiscal decision. That's it.
Good. Any of the panelists? Carolina, you may want to address the issue of Colombia. Then
Colombia. First, I agree Colombia has a very complex institution for PPPs and
for everything else.
For everything. I was going to say we are a country of, and I don't know if Mauricio will agree with me, but we are a country of lawyers and laws and interpretation of the law and the contract. And therefore, and it's completely right what you say. When you compare the lawyers that the private sector has with the lawyers that the public sector has, the ministries have, in order of designing the contracts, negotiating the contracts, and then looking for the contract compliance, there's a quite big disbalance in between public and public sector and private sector. And that's an issue that we have to address. And I would say when we were asked why aren't we using the blueprint of good contracts, one, we have to learn the blueprints of good contracts, and that's a homework that the countries need to do. They need to find out what the good contracts are. In Colombia, we have been trying. We have been working with the World Bank, IFC, for our longest concession. But now, when you go to the real world, you have all that has been done in the past, and there are reputational risks. I mean, if governments tend to change contracts, as in Colombia we tend to do, the players of the private sector know that there are good chances that contracts are going to be changed. So you have to, I guess, remain trying to do the homework. And I think there's also one other explanation besides power gain, which and political cycle, and it's governments have no time. If you tell a president that his road is going to be built in 5 years, because we have to start with the planning process, then you have to do all the contracts, then you have to open the licitation, and then it will either they change the minister or something happens. So I think there's a real challenge between the time, the execution time, the need to show results, and the need to have good contracts and good and I really don't know how to improve in that area. And in terms of integration, I think you need political will. I mean, you need political power, you need presence, and you need ministries to really want to integrate the countries. There are sectors that are easier than others, but I think multilateral agencies, international financial entities and agencies, they have a big role to play in this integration of infrastructure.
Thank you. Claudio, you may want to comment something on the fiscal rules.
Well, the first thing I want to say is something about piracy. That it was not a general statement that all pirates on both sides. It's just that there are a few that are very well known. Now, in terms of the rules, first of all, I want to say the issue of transparency, which is mentioned in the report, is exceedingly important, and I agree with Teresa on that point, that you have to have rules that are clearly understood, not that they are easy to understand. We have to provide some employment to lawyers in every country. But fundamentally, this, I think, is the most important one. And in terms of fiscal rules, I understand that the golden rule is a problem, that you have to find some type of solution where find the adequate balance between the political needs of the president, so you may have a lot of inaugurations of works, so cutting ribbons and things like that. But you have to have a long-term long-term view, but maintaining quality of projects, and that is something that is very difficult to do from a political economy point of view. Just one more comment in terms of the balance between the private and the public sector, and what is the sort of the right mix. Unfortunately, after many years of looking at these issues, I cannot come up with an easy rule. I mean, because you can have a well-run public sector enterprises, so it doesn't matter. Really, the principle is to have well-run enterprises with accountability and transparency. And what we have, over the years, come up with a sort of a shortcut, saying private sector tends to be more efficient, and therefore it's better to go to the private sector. But it is not always the case. And of course, you can have private enterprises that are monopolies that are run extremely poorly and take advantage of the government. Then you have others, I think of Codelco as the copper company of Chile as one that, even with many scandals, has been much more efficient than many private sector enterprises. So I don't think there is a golden rule. It's just a question of balance and understanding of what goes on, and the issue of transparency is crucial.
Thank you.
Although I like the private sector better in principle.
José Luis.
Yeah, a couple of things I'll mention. One on the fiscal rules. Yes, indeed, it's an issue. Now, fortunately, countries are beginning to respond more effectively on the way to manage contingent liability. Only Chile was the one. Colombia has got into it. Peru is thinking of in that direction with a more systemic tie, not only registering liabilities, but managing them, understanding that there should be a limit, a top, in terms of GDP and the like, understanding, you know, annual accumulative basis, what have you. That's something that, you know, thank God it's been moved forward, it's improving. Second, I mean, I don't know, just the issue that concerns me and illustrates the problematic that somehow has been presented here, and one of the elements is what Carolina was saying. Quite often I go and meet, you know, with discuss infrastructure and PPP, and I meet with the finance minister or whatever, even the prime minister, what have you. And I usually post him a simple question and say, you tell me, how would you judge the success of an infrastructure or PPP program? And don't give me the whole kitchen sink to tell me, oh, I want, you know, lower cost, I want everything done. That's impossible, okay? But at the end, you have to say, what do you want? Really, the number of projects being built within a year or within 5 years, number of investments, unit cost, minimum unit cost, a minimum number of disputes, increased sector coverage, or what have you. I mean, that's to me the critical thing, because that, understand that nothing can be perfect. Or you want one beautiful best practice project a year, that would be satisfied? Well, that obviously is not going to work. But you have to be realistic, understand that these are complex matters and you will make mistakes. You should be able, which mistakes are you willing to absorb? In areas of expediency, you might want to say, look, I need to build so many, you know, water connections or electricity connections or roads in 3 years. That would imply shortcutting some of the process, mixing again of trying to get some more efficiency, additional resources or capacity, and then try to be coherent. But that's critical. But seldom, again, you don't have that type of answer to be able to build into it.
Thank you. Well, we're going to wrap up with Germán Ríos, who's the Director of Competitiveness, for the closing remark. He's from the Andean Development Corporation. I want to thank all of you, by the way, but...
Rubens Institution for giving us the opportunity to share this report with you. And when we write these reports, I'm sure the IDB, the World Bank, what we want to do is what Carolina mentioned, that the policymakers read the report, and if they find something useful, they can shape up the policies sometimes with some information that we generate in those reports. That's the idea. And for us, it's very important to do this kind of work. But I also think that there is a externality of doing this kind of report, and is how those reports also help
our institutions to improve our interventions in the countries. And I think that's a very important part of this work. And that we see sometimes that research in our institution is very separated from operations or policy, and I think that's a mistake. In CAF, we are starting to do this more often, using the knowledge we generate in these reports to start policy. I'm just going to give two examples of that. IRSA, excuse me, that was mentioned, and this is an IDB CAF project where we try to have this database of projects, integration projects, and try to build on what we have learned in the past, being one of the main providers of infrastructure, and put that to work in those kind of project. And the other thing, we learned today that infrastructure have so many externalities, have social externalities, competitiveness externalities, productivity externalities. And one thing we are starting to do, and I think this is something the multilateral have to do more often, is try to combine their interventions around single projects. We see so many times like roads and dams and electricity projects that are done without taking into account social environment seriously. And what I mean when I say serious is without doing other interventions to enhance the externalities of these projects. I'm just going to give one example. When we were discussing the Interoceanicas in Peru, that was a big discussion to continue with the discussion on Peru. One of the things and there was a big debate about the importance of this road. One thing we really wanted to do was to introduce in the projects the social intervention along the road, helping communities, to introduce the competitiveness factors, identifying what are the sectors that will benefit from the road, and try to also help to develop the productive activities there. So to close that, I think we need to come up with more integral approaches in order to take more advantage of these externalities that the infrastructure brings. And I think we haven't done a very good job in the past, but moving forward, I believe we will do this in a more efficient fashion. Once again, I thank Mauricio personally for having this is a part of the activities we have now that we have a partnership with Brookings, and we hope to come back again and continue to share our reports and research here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So I thank you also for having joined us and having been so patient. Thank you very much.